Hello and welcome to the Wednesday Midweek Bible Study Series, which we're doing on the Sermon on the Mount. And last Bible study, we finished up the section on the Beatitudes, and now we're going to go into a section where Jesus Christ talks about salt and light, and that we are the salt and the light. So let's go to that. As I said, last week we did the Beatitudes, finished that up, a lot to think about there. But as we move on, Jesus Christ is talking about the impact that those who have the Beatitude character will have on others. Now, those who have a merciful, they're mourned, peacemaking, meek, pure of heart, poor in heart, as well as a hunger and thirst for righteousness' sake, as well as maybe even being persecuted for righteousness' sake, will have an impact on those they come in contact with. And Jesus Christ refers to them as salt and light, the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And as we go a little bit beyond that section, he then goes in and talks about reinforcing the law and the prophets. He fulfills the law and the prophets, as he says. He talks about it and demonstrates that the righteousness of living by God's commandments from the heart and understanding what's in the heart that leads to murder, what's in the heart that leads to adultery, and talking about that, which is far beyond what the Pharisees of that day were talking about. They were just focused on the act, and they weren't able to speak to or comment or teach about what leads to murder, what leads to adultery, and how really breaking commandments is from the heart, not necessarily the action always. It can be the action, of course, but it's the heart, what starts in the heart. And that's what Jesus Christ is talking about changing, the heart. Now, as we go through the teachings that we'll see here, ask yourself each day maybe, and that would be a goal, each day, are you living as someone who reflects the salt of the earth? Are you living as someone who reflects being the light of the world? And how do we better live in a way that reflects God's spiritual righteousness that comes from his law being written on our hearts? And knowing how to apply God's law, the spiritual intent of it. So think about those things as we go through this section here. Matthew 5:13, we'll begin here today. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled upon underfoot by men. So Jesus Christ says, you are the salt. Now he's talking to those who think about this. This is the Sermon on the Mount, so there's sort of a higher up area, a hill or small, what's called the mount, but really it was really a smaller hill up from the Sea of Galilee near Capernaum. And he's speaking, and below him are the disciples that would become the apostles, disciples, and also a crowd begins to probably form. And he's talking to those people. Well, who else is he talking to? Well, he's talking to the church of God, the ecclesia, those who are the assembly or been put into an assembly, you know, brought out of the world, put into this assembly of God, the ecclesia of God, the called out ones of God, you might say. These are becoming the salt and the light. Now, let's talk about salt. Salt, I want to have three sort of characteristics of salt that I'd like us to consider. They are part of an offering. Salt is part of an offering. It's a preservative and it's a flavor. So let's talk about the offering as salt as part of an offering. Now we see in Leviticus 2 verse 11, if you want to turn there, Leviticus 2 verse 11, about the instructions of an offering. Here it says, no grain offering which you bring to the Lord shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven nor any honey in any offering to the Lord made by fire. As for the offering of the first fruits, you shall offer them to the Lord, but they shall not be burned on the altar for a sweet aroma. And every offering of your grain offering, you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Now, all the offerings that were defined to do, I won't go through them all, but each one of them represented Jesus Christ in some way. He was a living sacrifice, and each one of these offerings he fulfilled, or sacrifices he fulfilled in his life and giving of his life. But here it says what we just read in contrast to honey and leaven. So he says, don't put honey and leaven in there. Well, why not? Well, I think leaven might be obvious, but honey, why not honey? Well, honey tastes great, but it has a way in which it decays. And also if you burn it, it smells, you know. Burning honey does not smell very good. And these are supposed to be sweet aromas to God. They represent going up to him, to his very throne, and even the prayers are kind of represent, you know, that as well. So honey doesn't have a very nice smell when it's burnt. But a covenant of salt, what does that reflect? Well, a covenant of salt reflects a relationship agreement that does not decay or deteriorate, but continues on. Now let's talk about a covenant versus a contract. Somebody once referred to their relationship as a contract with God. They'll do certain things, God will do certain things, and there'll sort of be a contract there. Well, that's probably not really the right way to look at it. A better way to look at it is a covenant. A covenant. Now what's the difference between a covenant and a contract? You have similarities, you know, where two parties sometimes will agree to do certain things. Well, a covenant, one of the key things about a covenant that's different from a contract is a covenant is about a relationship, a long-term relationship with somebody. In this case, a covenant with God is you and God. And it's intended to last and develop and grow and not deteriorate. A contract is simply, it has a time period. One party does something, another party else fulfills it or does what they're supposed to do. You know, there's payment made and it's over with. That's a contract. Well, covenant is supposed to last. It reflects a relationship. It does not decay or deteriorate, but continues on. Salt is a preservative, and a covenant of salt is intended to be long-lasting or with no desire for it to cease. So God doesn't want a relationship or a covenant with Israel to decay or degrade. He didn't want that. He wanted a covenant that was going to go for some time, so it was a covenant of salt. The offerings were an aspect of how the covenant relationship between God and Israel were to intended not to decay but to continue on. And sadly, as we know, Israel began to do things that didn't allow that covenant to stay in place, ultimately. But in our covenant with God, you know, which has happened in baptism, that's a covenant between you and God. That's intended to last for eternity. That's the intent. And so in a sense, the covenant of salt applies to us. You know, we are to have forever and ever and ever eternity. However your mind can wrap itself around that idea of eternity is what God wants to have relationship, have that relationship be, and to grow and to develop and never to deteriorate. Now, there's two examples that I can give you of this covenant of salt idea being used in conversations or examples in the Bible in the Old Testament that represents the idea of a relationship agreement that is not intended to deteriorate or decay or fall apart over time. We see one example in 2 Chronicles 13, verses 4 and 5. It says, then Abijah, who was the king of Judah, stood on Mount Zemaraim, which is in the mountains of Ephraim, and said, hear me, Jeroboam, and all Israel. Should you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the dominion over Israel to David forever, to him and his sons, by a covenant of salt? So here we have this idea that's being presented by Abijah that there's this covenant of salt in this agreement, this covenant. And God expressed this to David, where he would be king forever, well, or his descendants would be. Well, God did fulfill that. The kingdom of Israel did split, but the part that remained Judah, the southern kingdom, well, David and his descendants stayed there, and God was true to that covenant. And even today, we have his descendants sitting on thrones in Europe. And we'll see that all the way to the very time that Jesus Christ comes and continues to fulfill that covenant of salt. He is a descendant of David. So Numbers 19:19 is another example where it says, all the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offered to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you. So here we have another example, again, of this covenant of salt, this idea that it's a covenant that's supposed to stay in place, to not deteriorate, not to fall apart, not to decay, but to continue on. That's the intent. And that's what a covenant of salt or salt represents in an offering as well. All right, let's go into another attribute of salt. Salt is a preservative. Now, in a sense, we kind of just covered that briefly, or it kind of was an aspect of a covenant of salt, but salt is a preservative. For ages, there were no refrigerators. Well, how do they keep meat? Well, I think we know. We've got beef jerky today, and in South Africa, they have something called biltong. Well, simply, it's meat, dried meat that's been cured with salt, and it can last for a long, long time, even though it's not refrigerated. Salt preserves the meat. No germs can survive in the salt. Salt is an essential component of human diet and life. The earth is, as we know, in a state of decay due to sin. Yet God's people are a preserving agent. I don't know if you ever thought about it that way, but we can look at Noah, who in a sense was a preserving agent for mankind, and we'll see even for the animals in that sense, because they are all kind of preserved by what God did through Noah. And even the church, as we'll see, is in a sense a preserving agent for the world. So let's look at Genesis 6. You can turn there, Genesis 6. Let's just turn to verses 11 and 12 and break into this section here of Genesis, Genesis 6, and we'll go to verse 11 and 12, where we see the state of the world, the state of the earth. It says, the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Now, God chose not to destroy all mankind, but save it through Noah, because he was a righteous person. In a sense, he was a preserving agent for all mankind. We see this in verse 18 of Genesis 6. It says, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you, and of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. So here we see that God found Noah to be righteous on the earth, and through Noah preserved the human life so it could continue on. And likewise, the church is, in a sense, a preserving agent for the earth. In Matthew 24, verse 22, the Olivet prophecy here, Jesus Christ, as it's called, telling the disciples what's going to happen at the end times. And he says in verse 22, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So we get this sense, this idea, this future time where, you know, all mankind would probably just blow themselves up or destroy themselves, except that God does not allow that to happen. Jesus Christ does not allow that to happen. And for the elect's sake, the church, the elect, the saints, he does not allow that to be happening. So in a sense, the church is a preserving agent in a sense. And that's why, you know, another aspect of Jesus Christ saying, you are the salt. All right, let's go to a third attribute or characteristic of salt. It gives flavor. Now, I think most of us are familiar with that. Salt loses its value only if it loses flavor and preservative qualities. And that's what Jesus Christ says. And he gives a warning about salt losing its flavor. Luke 14, verse 34 and 35, we get another aspect of Jesus Christ using this idea of salt is good, but if it doesn't have flavor or preservative quality, you know, what good is it? He says in Luke 14, verse 34, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So what can you use salt for if it's lost its value in seasoning? Well, it really can't be used. And Jesus Christ says you can't put it on the land. You can't put it, make it as a fertilizer. It creates problems if salt gets into the soil. There are areas where salinization of soil occurs, which wreaks havoc on most plants. So it's whole areas where too much salt gets in the soil and they have to do things to get the salt out of the soil so plants can thrive. So salt is really good for nothing. Jesus wasn't really talking about Chicagoland where we use salt on the roads. Suppose it's good for the salt. It's good for the roads when it snows. But really, you know, in the context of what Jesus Christ was saying, salt is really not worth anything if it loses its flavor or preservative qualities. Now, there's an example of this. I heard Mr. Fay one time use this example, and it's actually found in several commentaries, including the Adam Clark commentary about this traveler who went to Judea. His name was Maudrell, and he writes about his experience of finding salt. And he makes some very interesting observations about this salt. And he says, and he writes this letter, there's an aspect of it. I broke a piece of it, talking about the salt, of which that part that was exposed to the rain, the sun, the air, though it had the sparks and particles of salt, yet it had perfectly lost its savor. The inner part, which was connected to the rock, retained its flavor or savor, as I found by proof. So, you know, he's making sort of a spiritual analogy here that the salt that he saw that was exposed to the elements of the world, in this case, he's talking about the sun, the rain, and the wind, had lost its flavor. And he's sort of saying, well, if the Christian's too exposed to the world or stays exposed to the world and its ways, you can kind of lose your flavor, you know? So there's a lesson there. And he also made the observation, which is also important, that the salt, the piece of salt that he broke off that was close to the rock. Now, who's the rock? Or who can we, you know, look to as the rock? I think we know the answer, Jesus Christ. So, but the salt that was close to the rock still had flavor, and there's a lesson for us. Stay close to the rock, you know, stay attached. Jesus Christ even says at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, you know, about standing, he who does the teachings of Jesus Christ is like the one who stands on a rock and can stay and withstand storms and winds and other things that come along. So stay on the rock, be close to the rock, be close to Jesus Christ. There's a lesson for that about not losing your flavor as salt. And being too exposed to the world, well, that can bleach out the flavor and the value of the salt, you might say. So something to think about. Thought I'd share that with you. Now let's go on to the next part, which is the light of the world. Now we see this in Matthew 5, verse 14, 15, and 16, where Jesus Christ says, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your God, your Father in heaven." Now let's consider light. And let's also consider that the world is under the power of darkness. Why is it? You know, people don't always realize that. Why is it under, you know, is the world under darkness? Well, let's see what Colossians 1 verse 12 says. Colossians 1 verse 12, and we'll read to verse 13, says, "Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of his love. So here we see, what is the power of darkness? Well, it's being under the sway of and deception of the evil one. The power of darkness is what Paul calls it in Colossians. And it really does have an impact. You know, the power of the evil one, there is one. Ephesians 6:12, Paul talks about this. He says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places." So we have this rulers of darkness of this age, you know, that we're talking about, that the world is under the sway of the evil one, the power of darkness. Revelation 12:9, well-known scripture, says, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world." He was cast to the earth. Now, do we understand, does the world believe it's deceived by the whole world? Well, it does not. You can go to Galatians 5:19. There's a whole list of the works of flesh that are part of the works of being under the power of darkness. There's a whole list there. And you can see from adultery all the way to revelries and everything in between and the like. There's a lot there. Well, these are all aspects of being influenced by the power of darkness and the works that come from the power of darkness, the people that influence these type of behaviors. So all of these fall into the world. We know that, as we stated, we've read before in 1 John 2, verse 16, that all that is in the world, well, who influenced the world? Well, Satan the devil does. He deceives the whole world, and it's described as the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So the world claims to be enlightened. You know, my son last year took a class that was called European History. And the first part of that class was talking about coming out of the Middle Ages sometimes even called the Dark Age, you know, where they believed knowledge, there was not that much knowledge, was not flowing. What the beginning of that class talks about coming out of that time period into the age of enlightenment, you know, where there's the age of reason and humanism and thinking, you know, rational thinking, and all these types of things that came out of that idea is called enlightenment. So in the sense that society was enlightened. These days, I think we have a similar term called being woke. But whether society is enlightened or woke or whatever you want to call it, the reality is that isn't a reality. It's under the power of darkness. Why would we have, if we have the age of enlightenment that we are in, now we're in a new age that people talk about, you know, and yet there's more depression, more anxiety, more mental health issues, more unhappiness, more strife, more conflict than we've ever had before. So being enlightened, if we're so enlightened as a society, you know, these things should all be going away, but it's not, because really it's under the power of darkness, and people just don't realize, deceived by the ruler of this age who deceives all the world, Satan the devil. So the way of peace escapes society. So let's talk about being a light. You know, being a light, you know, how is a light demonstrated? Well, Jesus says through good works. Good works or deeds. Now, the Bible talks a lot, amazingly a lot, about works or deeds. Now, can we earn our salvation? No, we cannot. But God expects good works. He expects light. And light means things that, deeds or things that we do that reflect something very, express light, reflect on him. Titus 2:14. Let me just give you a few scriptures. I spent a lot of time on this, but Titus 2:14 says, "Who gave himself for us," talking about Jesus Christ, "that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works." Notice that, zealous for good works, good deeds. You know, 1 Timothy 6:18 says, "Let him do good, that they be rich. You know, it's talking about those that are wealthy. Paul has a section here at the end of 1 Timothy 6 here about talking about the rich. So let them do good, for they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. But whether rich or poor, good works, that's what God expects. Now, these are not works or deeds or things that are motivated to promote ourselves. You know, works or deeds that result in glorifying God, not us. Now, Jesus Christ shows later on in Matthew 6, verse 1 through 4 on the Sermon on the Mount, you know, that good deeds, an example of not glorifying God by doing something good, but really glorifying yourself. And he says that in Matthew 6, verse 1, where it says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. That's the motivation. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. So Jesus Christ is talking about being a light, having deeds that works that glorify the Father, not the self. And he talks about that more specifically later on in Matthew 6, as we just read. And you know, just as an example, you know, I've gone to different places, foundations, and you see sometimes on a wall or in a book you get all the people have gave something, and you very rarely see anonymous. You know, I've gone to some belong to certain things where there's massive amounts of giving encouraged, and there's people who give some very, very big amounts, and you see their name, you see their company, you see their foundation, and very rarely do you see anonymous, but sometimes you do. Well, they've got the reward. Well, whatever, as light, we used to do things in a way that do things to glorify the Father. 1 Peter 2:11 says this, beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, that they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of salvation. So here God's talking about being, Peter's talking about being a light in a sense, just like Jesus Christ. Peter would have heard exactly what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount. And here he's giving an aspect of what Jesus Christ said about glorifying God in the day of salvation. People will do that, even if they don't understand today, by your good works. So being a light glorifies God, if not now, at a later time. Now, we also can tell who are lights within the Church of God, even by our behavior, love, or to glorify the Father through our good works. But being a light, let's look at one more aspect, is in 1 John 2. 1 John 2, verse 9 to 11, John writes, the Apostle John writes, he who says he's in the light. So if you say you're in the light, you're in the light, and hates his brother is in darkness until now. He who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in the darkness, but does not know where he's going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. So here we see another aspect of being the light of the world, and we love our brothers and sisters. We really love all mankind. You know, God, Christ even says, love your enemies. But you can't say you're in the light and hate your brother or your sister, another person, really. And that's especially true in the church. That's what John's talking about. So the Beatitudes describe the character of Christ's servants, and we should ask, are we the salt of the earth, a life-preserving, a life-giving preservative that adds flavor? Or are we also the light of the world? Or are we walking in darkness ourselves, not seeing God's great purpose in his ways? We are, Jesus Christ says, you are the light. You are the salt. And hopefully what we just covered here helps us understand those aspects. Much could be said about salt. Much could be said about light. But we've covered a few things here. So hopefully you can consider that. Think about being the light every day. Think about being salt to whoever you may come in contact with. Not salty, but the salt. Someone who gives flavor, who helps add to the situation, who enhances, you might say. And also light, who helps bring out light in situations and is helpful in that way. Kind and helping be, as someone said in a previous Bible study, being part of the solution, not the problem. So be salt. Be the light, as Jesus Christ said. Think about how to do that with God's laws written on our heart and mind, having love, showing love to others, even being kind to those that aren't kind to us are certainly ways in which we can be salt and light at this time. So bye for now, and we'll see you next week.